This is a work of fiction. Honest. Ragbag presents Endless Impossible, written and performed by Frank Burton. Endless Impossible will also be available as a book, the fourth in the Ragbag series. Buy a copy for each of your friends. You'll be the talk of the town. Later on, we'll enter the footnotes section. That's the optional extra content for the hardcore members of the Ragbag Alliance. Let's continue with Endless Impossible. The roads were clear. I put my foot down, driving fast enough to ensure we got there in good time without freaking my passenger out too much. I have to admit I'm a little nervous about travelling, he admitted just before we set off. I was part of Eileen's group for 8 years altogether, 1996 to 2004. I only ever travelled by road a couple of times during those 8 years, and I haven't really done since either. What have you been doing? I said. Mostly I just stay at home. I'm comfortable there. I glanced over at him once we were on the motorway. You okay? I said. I'm fine, he said. It's fun, actually. I know I've been back a couple of years, but it's probably fair to say I'm yet to adjust to civilian life. Not sure I ever will. Is that how the others feel? I have no idea. I'll be honest with you, I said. I've been digging around. I found the details for another member of your group, Christopher Chaplin. Changed his name to Simon Yardley, I understand. I emailed him, too. Oh, Chris won't talk to you, said Tim. He vowed never to speak about it to anyone. He also promised never to speak to anyone from the group again. It's okay. He doesn't know anything I don't know. I'll tell you everything. Thanks, I said. And what about Dennis? What did he say when he left? Dennis didn't speak to me much, said Tim. I got the impression he thought I was a bit strange. Apparently he told a story to one of the others, something about wanting to be kidnapped. Yeah, I've heard that. So he didn't speak to you about leaving at all? Nope. One day he was there, the next he wasn't. It didn't affect our work. Dennis didn't contribute much. He didn't have an engineering background, wasn't scientific at all. Eileen seemed to think he'd be useful in terms of creativity, but really, our work was much more of a practical endeavour. It was just as well Dennis was gone by the time we got to Phase 2. He'd have been completely out of his depth. I had to scrunch my face up to prevent a grin from appearing at this stage. Not because I found it funny, but because I started thinking about Jenna and how apparently she'd been proven correct. Jenna's expression, nerd army, kept popping into my head. I had to concentrate to stop myself saying it out loud. So this place we're travelling to, that's where you lived, after you left the church? Yeah. What kind of place is it? You'll see. Feel free to spoil the surprise, mate. We got 2.5 hours yet. It used to be a farm, he said. There's a large house on it, plus a converted barn, enough to house us all comfortably. There's another large building round the back of the farmhouse where we did all the work. And this is the thing I have to see with my own eyes. Yeah. Was Eileen involved in all this work of yours? Of course she was. She lived there with you all? Where else would she have lived? I'm just wondering if she was there the whole time, or did she, you know, disappear from time to time? Oh, I see what you mean. No, she wasn't always there. Where did she go? She had a business to run, Equilateral Incorporated. That's where the startup fund came from, to buy the farm. So, yes, she was actively involved in the work we did on Phase 2, but she had lots of other responsibilities and other places to be. Did she travel internationally? Sometimes, for meetings, yes. I see where you're going with this, Frank. All this talk about her dodgy passports and fake names. I don't see why she'd need to do any of that. I'm just curious as to how long she was away on these overseas trips. Days? Months? Depends on what she was doing, he said. Could be a couple of weeks or 6 months. Once she was gone for a whole year. But that was okay. We had everything we needed. We knew she'd be back. How did she communicate with the group? How do you mean? When she was away? Oh, she wasn't able to. We didn't use phone or internet or anything. Her only option would have been through the mail. But letters can be intercepted. So we'd just continue with our work and wait for Eileen to return. What would have happened if she never came back? If she died or had an accident or ended up in prison or something? I told you we had everything we needed. We could have carried on living there forever, but, you know, we didn't. So you were there until 2004, 2 years after Eileen returned home. So Eileen didn't disband the organisation. Something else happened. The group decided it was time to go out into the world. And do what? Spread the word? Tim stared out of his window for a while. I pressed on. That was the plan, wasn't it? Once she was gone, her followers were supposed to reveal Eileen's angel's message to humanity. Funny thing is, I haven't heard a single thing about it this whole time. I've asked everyone I know, I've searched online, I've even checked the libraries. No one seems to have breathed a word about Eileen Angel's message to humanity. Why not? You'll see, he said quietly. And where are the others now? We didn't stay in touch. Why not, after all those years living together? Several reasons, said Tim. Not everyone believed by the end. The general consensus seemed to be that, he gritted his teeth as he forced out the words, Eileen's story wasn't true. Then there's the practicalities of maintaining contact with each other when there's so much we won't allow ourselves to talk about, even in private. Oh, I said, so there's stuff you're not going to say, things you're not willing to tell me. Just wait until we get there, he said. I'll tell you everything. I appreciate that, I said, I really do, but how come? These unspeakable secrets of yours, why share them with me? Because I trust you, Frank, and I think you deserve to know. It was late afternoon when we arrived at the site. The July sun still blazed above us. There was a sturdy entrance gate with a combination lock. Tim tapped in the code and swung it open. From there, it was still a mile's drive up to the farmhouse. The setup was just as Tim had described, but bigger than I'd expected. The house was more like a palace from the outside. Considering it hadn't been lived in for 2 years, the white walls seemed pristine. Are you sure there's no one living here? I said. Like who? He said. I'd be very surprised if any of the group chose to come back, even for a glance. How's it so clean? I said. We kept the place in good shape until we left. The same couldn't be said for the creaky metal warehouse out the back, visible through the gap between the original farmhouse and its attached barn conversion. We should go round the back first, he said. I was hoping to check the house out, I said. Looks nice. There's time for that, said Tim, but the answers aren't there. I followed him round the side of the house to a little wooden shed. He unlocked it and pulled out a pair of spades. You'll be needing this, he said, handing me one. I reached out my hand slowly, hesitant to take it. Don't worry, he said. We won't be digging up any dead people. Are you sure? I said. Well, if we do, it'll be a surprise to me too. He led me through to the warehouse, which apparently wasn't locked. He turned the lights on. Someone still paying the electric bill on this place, I said, blinking as I stared up at the strip lights on the ceiling. I guess the new owner does, he said. Some oligarch, apparently. Never even visited the place. The original owner's long gone, of course. I was wondering about that, I said. I'm guessing no one witnessed the spacecraft that came down and whisked her away. It didn't happen like that, he said. The spacecraft never entered the Earth's atmosphere. She used a portal. No one witnessed it. She wanted us all to be there and tried to arrange it somehow, but it just wasn't safe. The portal had to be placed in the middle of an empty field. The energy required to transport Eileen over that distance would have flattened anyone standing even 100 feet away. Was it one of these fields? I said, gesturing to the outside. It was miles away from anywhere. There could have been damage to the building if she'd done it here. Also, she had no control over the location herself. I'm sure it all went well. And where is she now? What's she doing? She's home. That's all anyone needs to know. Let's dig. I looked down, surprised to see we were standing on a rough mound of dirt. This place seemed like it ought to have a concrete floor, I said. It was only supposed to be temporary. When the rust sets in properly, it'll probably collapse. Luckily, we came before that happened. Would have been harder to dig. I followed Tim's lead, shoveling soil from the mound and tossing it against the wall. After his first few scoops, Tim's shovel made contact with metal. He He tapped it a few times, making a dull clank. "Here we go," he said, poking around with his fingers before pulling up a silver pipe with a broken joint at the end. "First piece." He continued digging and gestured for me to join him. Soon I discovered my own piece of the puzzle. More shiny metal joints and hinges, mixed up with bits of broken glass. "Can you tell what it is yet?" said Tim. I shook my head and continued digging. More and more bits of metal, twisted wires of various colours, plastic, more broken glass, a series of small rectangular panels, stained with various types of ink. "Come on," he said, "you haven't twigged yet." "Machinery," I said. "What kind?" "I don't know. Some kind of manufacturing thingamy? You were making something." "Making what?" "I have absolutely no idea." "Keep on digging. Trust me, you're going to like this." "Am I?" "I think you will," said Tim. "Like's probably a strong word. At the very least, you'll be impressed. Try digging towards the middle a bit more. There's more of it buried way over there." I climbed a little way up the mound and stuck my spade back into the dirt. A moment later, I spotted something sticking up between a collection of nearby stones. The corner of something. Paper. Purple and white. I fished it out. It ripped in half. I jumped on the spot. "Ha!" I roared. "I said you'd like it," said Tim. "£20, I yelled at him, waving the evidence in his face. "Looks real as well. There's only half of it here, but geez." I held it up to the light. "You've got the silver bits and everything, and the little queen's head." "It's as real as they come," he said. "All money's artificial, really." "It's not legal tender, though, is it?" I said. "Well, no, but..." "That's what all this is, right? You built your own printing press, whacked out a heap of forged twenties, then smashed the machine and buried it. It's not buried particularly well, but at least you made the effort to conceal it." "Are you impressed?" he said. "I admire your chutzpah, if that's what you mean," I said. "Christ, I need to sit down." I plopped myself back down on the dirt and closed my eyes. "Are you okay?" said Tim. "I'm fine," I said. "I just wasn't expecting this. Not at all." "What were you expecting?" "No idea," I said. "My best guess would have been a commune of some kind. Growing your own vegetables, writing poetry, painting pictures of equilateral triangles, living your best lives away from the rat race, that type of thing. Not a crime scene." "Sorry to disappoint you," he said, looking at the ground. "I'm going to need some details," I said. "How much money did you print?"
$10 million at first."
$10 million, I repeated. £10 million, at first." "Yes," he said. "And this was..." "Hang on. This was the plan all along, the whole time you were with Eileen Angel. The plan from day one was to design and build a printing press capable of producing foolproof £20 notes and then print £10 million worth of them, for starters." "That was the plan from day one," Tim confirmed. "So your community wasn't formed in order to spread Eileen Angel's message of peace to humanity?"
"That's exactly why the community was formed," said Tim.
"But instead of spreading a message of peace to humanity, you forged £10 million. You're going to have to help me out here, Tim. Clearly I'm missing something vital." "Think about it, Frank. How could we go about spreading Eileen's message without a budget? For starters, we needed money to live. There were 16 of us guys plus Eileen. One less after Dennis departed, but still, we all needed feeding. Then at the very least, we'd need a basic marketing budget, money for advertising, PR, a fully comprehensive website and social media. Who was going to pay for all that? Eileen had already invested tons of her own money, buying the church and the farm, plus all the materials we needed for phase two. None of it came cheap. So you just went along with it. You weren't put off by the prospect of life imprisonment."
Tim shrugged. "I wouldn't have got life. No violence. No victims.
Sure, you didn't kill anyone. Bravo. But there's still the principle of the matter."
"Principles," he snapped. "Don't you see we were working towards a greater goal here, Frank? We had a real chance here to do some good in the world.
The prospect of global peace may seem fanciful, but I genuinely believe we could achieve it. I still do. Yeah, how's that all going, by the way? How many hearts and minds have you won over with this message of yours? Tim swung his arms in frustration and sat himself down. He picked up two handfuls of soil and threw them against the ground. It just wasn't possible, in the end, he said quietly. Why not? One of the group, his name was Leonard. He was an accountant. All the money we printed, he was able to somehow transfer it all into the Equilateral Incorporated business account. He was the only one of us based off-site. He had a little office in a town close by to here, where he had internet access and whatever else he required to turn these banknotes into legitimate currency without raising red flags with the banks. I have no idea how money laundering works. I didn't need to know. It was Leonard's business. As I say, the target was £10 million. Enough to cover everything we needed for Phase 3, the message. We achieved that in time for Eileen's return home. There was time to spare, in fact. We relaxed for the first time in ages. On Eileen's final night with us, we had a massive party with, you know, all this normal stuff like drinks and music and... It wasn't for me, really, but the others enjoyed themselves. I said my goodbyes to Eileen and went off to bed. The following morning, Eileen was gone. Most of the guys were too hungover to do anything. That was the day she did it. Went off through the portal to the spacecraft and away. I wish I could have been there, but, you know, it's the way it had to be. The following day, Leonard returned home from his office in the biggest panic I'd ever witnessed in a man. He couldn't speak, could hardly breathe. Myself and another member of the group sat with him in his room, holding his hands, encouraging him to take deep breaths. I've never been very good at that sort of thing, but it worked in the end. Once he'd relaxed enough to hold a conversation, we found out what had happened. The money. All of it. Every penny of that 10 million was gone. I covered my mouth. Are you laughing, Frank? I'm sorry, I said. I know it's not appropriate. I don't know how else to react, but please continue. I'm listening. I'm taking it seriously. I promise, mate. Okay, he said. You can probably guess the rest, but the place kind of exploded for a while. It was chaos, everyone talking at once, yelling, screaming. The rage in that building was enough to power a jet. The names they were calling Eileen, words I'd never heard erupting from those mouths before in all the years I'd known them. It all seemed so simple to them. Eileen had double-crossed a lot of us. She'd run off with our money. I know you think we're cheats and liars ourselves, Frank, but you can't say we didn't work for it. The hours, the days, the months, the years. We spent fine-tuning that machine until it spat out the perfect banknote, not to mention the actual hard graft involved in running it over and over again. 10 million doesn't just pop out from nowhere. And after all that, this witch, this devil... They used far worse terminology than that. She'd stolen it all from us. The more they ranted and raved at each other, the more it became clear. They weren't so much angry with Eileen as angry at themselves for believing her story, because, of course, her claims were pure fiction. How can they have been so stupid? The more they began to think along those lines, the quieter they became until they fell almost completely silent. A few members of the group were literally speechless for a number of days. The small handful of us who still trusted Eileen with our lives kept quiet too. We knew she was gone. We knew we had a mission to fulfil. But we didn't have the words to defend or explain Eileen's actions. As far as the majority were concerned, she'd taken our 10 million quid and fled the country. I'm sure that's what you think too, Frank, and I don't blame you either. That's the way it looks, after all. What do you think she did? I said. Why did she take the money? There wouldn't have been a need for it out in space. Honestly, I don't know, said Tim. Maybe there was an outstanding bill she needed to pay, and she settled it so the group wouldn't be left with the debt. Anyway, I don't see things the same way as the others. She didn't steal £10 million from us. Didn't she? Not really. We had our own minting machine. All we needed to do was print another 10 million, or 20, or 100. Right, so, hang on. So, that's what you did. You said you printed 10 million for starters. So Eileen disappeared with the money and you... We printed some more, yes. Once the dust had settled, we picked ourselves up from our beds and went back to work. It wasn't the same, of course. Eileen was gone. Pretty much everyone hated her and resented the fact that we were here in the first place. Still, we carried on working. The machine was capable of producing 20,000 pounds a day when working at full capacity. That's just over 7 million per year. The original 10 million took more like 3 years altogether. The machine required constant maintenance, constant attention. Everything needed to be thoroughly checked. Once Eileen was gone, we just got straight back into it, working 7 days a week, only spending what we needed to survive. We could have splashed out on sports cars or the latest home entertainment tech, but the last thing we wanted to do was draw attention to ourselves. I remember thinking, yes, this is good. We're actually doing this. All we need is a couple of years to reprint all the money, then the serious business of spreading Eileen's message can begin. I made the mistake of saying this out loud one evening when several of the group were in earshot. They said, really, Tim? Is that what you think we're doing? I said, what are we doing then? They said, don't you understand? We're printing as much money as we can so we can split it into 13, go our separate ways and never speak of this experience to anyone again. 13, I said. It's true, said Tim. There were only 13 of us by that point. What happened to the other two? I'll get to that, he said. Where was I? So, yes, we printed the money. The job carried on, and whether I liked it or not, I continued working just as hard as anyone else. As the days passed, conversations grew more and more irregular. Sometimes I felt their eyes burning into me, passing judgment on the sap who still believed Eileen Angel was an alien. I comforted myself with the knowledge that every single one of them had wholeheartedly believed Eileen's story. What had really changed? Some money had gone missing. That was all it had taken to break their faith. Was Eileen the traitor, or were they? I knew whose side I was on. Go our separate ways sounded good to me. The payoff sounded good too. All Leonard needed to do was transfer each group member their share. I tried not to think too much about what the future might hold. What kind of world would I be returning to after all this? I had no idea what was happening beyond those gates. I hadn't watched TV or listened to the radio or even seen a news headline since 1996. When I finally got out, Tony Blair had been Prime Minister for 7 years. I had no idea who he was. I heard about 9/11 3 years late. I missed the entire Matrix trilogy. Star Wars Episodes 1 and 2. I would have got the DVD set, but I had no idea what a DVD was. I bought myself a nice house. That's where I spend most of my time. I don't need to work. As I mentioned, I've got plenty of movies still to catch up on. It isn't a bad life. At some point, I'll start feeling more comfortable about going outside, interacting with the real world. I've done okay today, haven't I? Went to a cafe, had a solid conversation, even went on the motorway. You've done very well, I agreed. I'm worried about you, though, Tim. Who do you have in your life looking out for you? Family? I speak to them sometimes. They're still angry that I ran away. Surely they were happy to hear you're still alive. Oh, they knew I wasn't dead, said Tim. Same with all the other group members. From time to time we'd all write letters to the people we'd left behind, assuring them we were okay, asking them not to come looking for us. We needed time to discover ourselves. Vague little platitudes like that. I'd always reassure my family I'd be returning as soon as I could. Turns out they had a hard time accepting it all. Maybe one day. How about friends? I made some friends online, he said brightly. Mostly in the Star Wars community. I haven't mentioned Eileen to any of them. I don't think I will. It's good to know you're not alone, I said. Please don't feel sorry for me, he said. I'm rich, I'm comfortable, I've got no regrets. Actually, that isn't true. I have a couple. But all of this stuff, he waved his arms around the room, I regret none of it. You might think that makes me a bad person, but... Nah, I said, no judgment from me, mate. There may be by the time I'm finished, he said. That's not the end of a story. Let me show you the house. From the smell in the stale air, it became apparent that the group hadn't cleaned the place out before they left. There were a stack of old plates in the kitchen sink, licked clean over time by the flies. Your DNA's going to be all over this stuff, I said. What does it matter, said Tim. There'd be nothing for the police to match it up against. None of us have criminal records. Nice place, I added. It is, isn't it? I liked living here for the most part. Shall I show you the bedrooms? Is this just a guided tour of your old home, or is there more to the story here? I'm surprised you haven't asked the question yet, he said. But what do you think happened if someone got sick? We'd sworn not to reveal our identities to anyone, and we definitely weren't prepared to disclose our address. Couldn't just rock up at A&E if one of us happened to break an arm. Fair point, I said. I didn't think of that. Well, luckily we managed to avoid most medical emergencies. But in case we ran into trouble, one of the group happened to be a doctor. Right, so he'll have been recruited specifically for that purpose. Perhaps, he said. Apparently he was Eileen's GP. He was older than everyone else. He left his wife and kids to come and join the group. She must have been persuasive. The point is, he believed her story. He trusted Eileen. He was loyal to the end. His name was Terence Starling. The lads renamed him Telstar. Let me show you. I followed Tim up a spiral staircase leading to a row of small bedrooms, each equipped with a single bed. It reminded me of a prison corridor. I kept the comparison to myself. Tim led me through to a room with an unmade bed with musty-smelling covers. This is the bed Telstar died in, he said. He called out to us, couldn't breathe properly, could hardly move, kept pointing to his chest like it was a game of guess the diagnosis. We told him we'd send someone into town to call an ambulance. He shook his head. Don't do it, he said. Please. We said we can carry him down to the gates. The paramedics wouldn't need to enter the site. No one needed to exchange any names. They could treat him and he could come back. It's not worth the risk, he said. Kept on saying that over and over until it's not worth the risk were his final words on this earth. God, I said softly. Tim led me through to another of the bedrooms, three doors down from Telstar's. This was C's room. That's what we called him anyway. Full name was Mark Holloway. Mark with a C, he kept calling himself. So everyone chimed in, calling him Mark with a C, whenever they wanted his attention. After a while, we just shortened it to C. Funny how these things stick. C was an older chap, too. Well, I say older. He was the same age as we are now, when we started out. He met Eileen when she sold him a solar panel. He was close friends with Telstar. I guess they had more of a connection because they were a bit older than the rest of us. Younger than Dennis, of course. Did Dennis have a nickname? Grandad. I smirked. Not very original, I know, said Tim. Rather discriminatory too, in hindsight, but that's the way it was. 20th century boys. So, what happened to C? Oh, said Tim, yes. This is where C died, a couple of days after Telstar. He hung himself. Oh, no. This is what I regret. We could have saved Telstar. We could have ignored his insistence on calling an ambulance. Once he was gone, it was obvious C wasn't okay. Wouldn't talk to anyone, wouldn't eat, wouldn't leave his room. Instead of attempting to save him, we just left him to it. 2 days later, he was gone too. Now they're buried out the back. I'll tell you exactly where, in case you decide to report it. Behind the tool shed, where we got the spades. There's a rock placed over the top. It's the best we could do for a headstone. I don't understand why you're telling me this, I said. Sorry to burden you with this, Frank, he said. The truth is, I had to tell someone. Thank you for listening. I didn't know what to say. My best response was to pat him lightly on the back while he bowed his head. By the way, he added, their families still think they're alive. One of the group was particularly good at mimicking his friend's handwriting. Really? I said. How does that surprise you? We successfully copied banknotes. Writing a couple of letters home from time to time was child's play. As far as I know, he's still writing letters to C and Telstar's loved ones. He moved to Australia and does it from there. Do you think they deserve to know the truth? I said. Honestly, Frank, I don't know. In a way, I don't see what good it would do them. Much better to have them believe the lads decided to leave their old lives behind and they're out there somewhere doing whatever it is they went out there to do. Truth is overrated. You reckon? I said. Tim nodded. I know how that sounds, but I stand by it. I understand, I said. I know what you mean. Let's get out of here. Shall we talk about the elephant in the room? I said, when we were back on the road. Tim slapped himself on the forehead and exhaled noisily. Finally! he proclaimed. "Are we talking about the same elephant?" I said. "I don't know. Which elephant are you talking about?" "Eileen Angel," I said. "We've talked about her." "Neither of us have mentioned the obvious yet." "Which is?" I was reluctant to say it out loud, just as I'm reluctant to dwell on this particular detail in this story. It's impossible to say it without diminishing her character somehow. There was more to Miss Angel than this. Still, I had to say it. "She's the most beautiful woman I've ever seen," I said. "Hmm," he said. "You don't agree?" "Oh, I'm sure she is," said Tim. "I just didn't think you were going to say that." "I was just wondering, to what extent did Eileen's good looks influence your decision to join her group?" "None at all." "So, forgive the expression, but are you saying you'd have followed her even if she looked like the elephant in the room?" "I would," said Tim. "I can only speak for myself. Several members of the group were head over heels in love with her. Telstar definitely was. I suspect he left his wife because he judged, incorrectly, that he'd found himself another one. But it wasn't the case for everyone. Your friend Dennis didn't seem charmed by her at all. I found Eileen attractive, but the story, that's what lured me in. The story was everything. I was a fish out of water before I heard it. No friends, couldn't relate to anyone. Then she came along. Her story was my story. I'm just saying, surely it's no coincidence all of Eileen's followers were heterosexual men." "Of course it's not a coincidence," Tim snapped. "Steady on," I said. "You haven't thought about this at all, have you, Frank? Open your eyes wide enough, you'll see a beautiful woman on every street, in every town in this country. You think all those men were following Eileen around with their tongues hanging out? Give them some credit. And give her some credit, too." "Sorry," I said. It's not a coincidence," he continued. "It was part of the plan. She made that clear from day one. If there were women there, too, we'd inevitably end up pairing off. Then either we'd leave, or we wouldn't have our minds on the job, or worse than that, we'd fight." "So you were kind of like monks, then?" "Ha," said Tim. "Not exactly." "How do you mean?" "Well, some of the guys would, you know... Actually, you don't need to know. Forget I mentioned it." "Already forgotten," I said. "Talk about something else." "Well, something else has occurred to me as it happens. The letters you guys sent home. Whose idea was that? Eileen's?" "I can't remember," he said. "I think a couple of the guys decided to do it, let their families know they hadn't disappeared off the face of the earth. It seemed like a good idea, so everyone else followed suit." "Dennis didn't," I said. "Didn't he?" "He used to write letters to me all the time before he left for Devon. Everyone else I spoke to, former colleagues, his ex-wife, his former landlord, none of them received any letters." "Was he running away from something?" I said, "I guess so. Sounds like he'd run up some debt he couldn't pay. He'd already walked out on his kids. In a box of his old paperwork, I found a letter he'd written to me, but didn't have the heart to send it. He sounded utterly miserable. I guess that's what leads people to join cults, isn't it?"
"Join what?" said Tim.
"Whoops," I thought. Wasn't supposed to mention the C-word. "It wasn't a cult." I was speaking hypothetically. "As a matter of fact, Dennis was probably the only member of the group who needed to escape from his old life. That's probably why he didn't manage to stay. The group wasn't a refuge for lost souls. We were idealistic young men seeking adventure on a mission to change the world for the better. It was no place for a tired old cynic. No offence, but I believe that's what Dennis was." "You're probably right," I said. Tim asked me to drop him off a couple of streets away from his house. I think he was embarrassed by the flashiness of the place. I didn't have the heart to tell him I'd driven past it on the way here and stolen a peek through the gates. "Hell of a day," I said as I pulled up on the curb. "It's good to have met you."
"You don't need to say that," he said.
"Say what?"
"It's good to have met you."
"It is, honest." "Sure, if you want to play that game."
"Game?"
"Pretending you don't know who I am."
I stared at him in the semi-darkness.
"You would have enjoyed it, you know," he said. "I know it didn't end well, but it would have been nice to have had you there. We had some good times. I realise it was never for you.
Personally, I knew as soon as she stepped into that classroom, there was something special about Eileen Angel. And I knew that you were never going to see it. All those questions, picking the story apart. What about this? What about that? I don't know if you saw, but I was watching through the window that day when your dad brought Miss Angel's picture back into class. I don't know what she said to him, but he left with a smile on his face. She had that effect on people. Anyway, mate, thanks for the lift. Good to have seen you. Again. Stay in touch, yeah? I said, yeah. All right. Then he was gone. Okay, so I've remembered his name now. In my defence, he looks very different nowadays. Also, all those years he sat next to me in class, he was known as Timothy Steele, which is a very different name to Tim Steele, if you think about it. Twice as many syllables. I procrastinated for a couple of years before contacting the authorities. Part of me believed Tim was right. The truth was indeed overrated. They were better off not knowing. Another part of me liked Tim very much and had no wish to get him into trouble. Then I thought, he'll probably be fine anyway. In 2008, I sent an anonymous letter to the police in the town close by to the farm, letting them know where the bodies of Terence Starling and Mark Holloway were buried. I only know their names, I added. I don't know when they were born or where they're from. I never met them. I just heard the story. It's worth noting they're probably not listed as missing because they wrote to their families asking them not to come looking for them. Apparently someone is still doing that on their behalf from Australia. No, really. It's worth having a good old dig around the site while you're excavating the graves, by the way. Not telling you how to do your jobs or anything. Thanks. I signed my name at the bottom, then deleted it. Force of habit. I was too exhausted to drive all the way home after dropping Tim off, so I booked myself into a hotel for the night. I texted Heidi, letting her know I'd be home Sunday afternoon. She texted back a couple of hours later. No worries, I'm drunk. Kiss, kiss. I picked the text up the following morning and thought about it all the way home. When I got back to the flat, Heidi was flopped out on one of the beanbags with her feet up on the other. I kissed her and went to drop my bags in the bedroom. I marched back into the room a moment later. What's the deal with the bed? I said. How do you mean? It hasn't been slept in. Where did you sleep last night? I slept in the bed. The bed's made up, I said, in the exact same way it was made yesterday morning. No one's been in there. I was there when I slept in there. Alone? Of course I was alone. How do you explain the way it's made? Frank, I made the bed yesterday morning, then I made the bed again this morning. I make the bed every morning. I do it in the exact same way. What about Paul? I said. Paul? Your friend, your uni friend. Where did he sleep? I presume she slept at home. She? Paul's short for Pauline. Why didn't you tell me that? Why do you need to know? You said you were out with Ranch and Paul. I made a comment about Paul. I said, do you like him, or whatever. You had the opportunity to say Paul's a girl. Why play games with me like that? What games am I playing? Making me think you were out with a man when you weren't. So what if Paul was a man? What then? I wouldn't trust him. I don't trust other men. I trust you, obviously. Heidi rose to her feet. If you trust me, why are you asking if I slept alone last night, accusing me of not sleeping here? It wasn't an accusation, it was a question. I'm allowed to check up on what you're doing sometimes, aren't I? I'm going, she said. I'll sleep at Ranges tonight. Hang on, I said. Please, you can't do that. You can't punish me like this. I haven't seen you all weekend. You haven't seen me because you weren't here, she said. I offered to come, and I'm not punishing you. I just don't want to be around here when you're behaving this way. I'm sorry, I said. It's okay, you can cool off, whatever, but please come home tonight. I want to see you later. Heidi was already halfway out of the door. Don't sleep at Ranges, I said. Will her husband be there? I don't trust him. She'd already gone. Heidi left me a few months later. I'm sure I don't have to explain why. I was heartbroken for years. As far as I was concerned, she was perfect. Heidi was the saint. She was Susan from Susan's house, if only in my head. The truth is, I never allowed myself to get to know the real her. That's why Heidi, in her brief appearances in this story, probably comes across as fairly one-dimensional. You could say I'm just another male writer who can't do female characters properly. But I don't believe I am. The problem is me. I can't write about my relationship with Heidi without writing about me, because my relationship with Heidi was all about Frank Burton. I'd like to have an equal relationship with someone one day. I genuinely wonder what it's like. I hope Tim Steele finds someone to have an equal relationship with too. If anyone needs one, it's Tim. Tim's relationship with Eileen Angel was all about Eileen Angel. Even today, his life revolves around the woman who convinced him she was from space. For that matter, I hope Jenna finds what she's looking for out there, and my dad, and Dennis, and Vanessa, and all the other people who've gone missing from my life over the years. For what it's worth, over my 30-odd years' involvement with Miss Angel's story, I've learnt something. I wish I could put it into words myself. I really have tried. Thankfully, I have someone else's words. Someone who's done some proper research rather than snooping around abandoned buildings. So, in the words of Katie Hearn Church, I've been thinking a lot about what I've decided to call the Cleopatra conundrum, which is basically, how could this woman be so influential if she wasn't beautiful? Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, people literally cannot believe that such powerful men would have been swayed by Cleopatra unless she was beautiful. Cleopatra spoke like seven languages and was incredibly intelligent, funny, and an involved ruler of her people. But everyone's like, oh, her beauty. And then, Hypatia of Alexandria. She was educated, studied in Athens, was brought up to be a great mind, to be one of the greatest philosophers of all time. But all anyone wants to talk about is that she was beautiful. And I'm not saying she wasn't, but why does it matter? No one is ever Googling, was Plato hot? And then look at Anne Boleyn. Contemporaries of the time wanted to go out of their way to say she wasn't beautiful because they didn't agree with the movement she was affecting. The others liked to argue that she wouldn't have had so many men in love with her if she wasn't. Again, she spoke many languages. She could debate with the rest of them. She was funny, well-travelled, fashionable. All of those traits in a man, it wouldn't matter what he looked like. We see it also with Catherine the Great. At her coronation, someone felt the need to mention that she wasn't as beautiful as she once was. Has anyone said that about a single male ruler, ever? But did Catherine ever lack for companionship? No, men loved her. Catherine the Great was smart, well-read, had a great sense of humour, generous with her friends, loyal. Any man that had these traits, you wouldn't have to ask why people were drawn to them. You wouldn't ask what they looked like. You would just say, that's someone I want to know. In essence, that's it. I hope that's helpful. Maybe you're one of those people who instinctively knows this stuff already. The rest of us just need to catch up. That's about it, really. Or at least that's the end of the fourth ragbag book. Or indeed the audio version. Hey, listeners. I'll write another one after this. It occurs to me I almost managed to write a series of four books without anyone being killed. Not a single corpse. In Brollywood, I even got away with pulling that old trick of assuming a character is dead when it turns out they're alive, twice in the same book, and you fell for it. Ha 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 ha. But now I've concluded ragbag book number four with a pair of real bodies in the ground. All I can say is, there's more bodies to come. The fifth book will have loads of them in. Check it out if you like that sort of thing. I haven't written it yet. As you can clearly see, I'm still narrating this one. I was tempted to avoid telling you that last part about me reporting those bodies to the police because I'd be in danger of making this just another one of those stories. You know what I mean? Just another mainstream fable in which acts of kindness are rewarded and acts of cruelty are punished. If that's your bag, you could have ended this book satisfied. A bunch of stuff happened. Miss Angel got away scot-free, and Dennis never showed up again, but at least our brave protagonist reported those dead bodies to the cops. But that's not quite the end of the story. For starters, I only said the words "Dennis never showed up again" in order to refute them. In 2016, I received an email through the contact form on my website. "Dear Frank, it's just occurred to me that it's 20 years since we last saw each other. You're probably wondering where I've been. I've often wondered about you too over the years. I rarely use the internet and only just thought of Googling you last week. That type of research isn't in my nature anymore. Well, it is a bit. I have a story about that which I'd love to share with you. I live in the Northeast now. It's very nice here most of the time. Perhaps you've tried looking me up too at some point. I expect all you'll get is a bunch of old articles from the 90s, if anyone's bothered to stick them online. I call myself Alex Luther now. Dennis Gleason is dead. But seeing as it's you, I'll sign off. Ever yours, Dennis." We exchanged a few messages. I filled him in on what I've been up to over the last two decades, sugarcoating much of the harsher stuff. I didn't mention the prison sentence or my epilepsy diagnosis. I quickly glossed over the wasted years that followed the breakup with Heidi. The truth is, I spent a good 5 years or more unable to think straight. I couldn't write, I couldn't form relationships, not even a casual friendship. I kept thinking about that line from Miss Angel about Humpty Dumpty. It doesn't matter how far you fell, you can still put the pieces back together again. I kept thinking how wrong she was. I was broken beyond repair. Every single person who'd ever meant anything to me had disappeared or cast me aside. I didn't tell Dennis any of this because he was one of those people. I didn't want to sound bitter. I wasn't bitter. It was good to hear from him. I didn't mention my dealings with Tim and Miss Angel either. I couldn't be bothered to bring any of that stuff up. He usually took a few weeks to respond to each message. He started each reply with, "Sorry, Frank, as I may have mentioned, I rarely use the internet." Eventually, he passed on his phone number, and we arranged to meet for coffee one Wednesday afternoon. It turned out we both worked weekend shifts. I took a train up to the town where he lived. He met me at the station. He was slimmer, greyer, and dressed completely differently to the Dennis I knew. Trainers, sweatshirt, jogging bottoms, baseball cap. His smile was unmistakable. I shook him by the hand, smiling back. "You're looking well," I said.
"Thanks," he said. "You're looking old. You're a man."
"I guess that's how time works, eh?" He laughed.
"Come on, let's get a drink," he said.
We sat ourselves down in a nearby Starbucks. "So where have you been?" I said. "I mean, how have you been?"
"Well, is probably the best place to start," he said. "That assignment of ours, the cult leader in that old church. Remember that?"
"Of course," I said. "Sorry I didn't come with you."
"That's okay," he said. "Trust me, you'd have hated it. It was an awful job. I don't know why I took it on. Well, I do know why. The fame and the money. Exposing a crook was part of it too, I suppose, but I had to be honest. Mostly it was self-interest. I spent a whole year and a half living in that grubby little commune, assuring myself I was playing the long game. Then I woke up one morning and looked at my situation. I was spending 12 hours a day with a bunch of drones who'd voluntarily placed themselves under this horrible woman's spell. What was I doing there? Fame and fortune? I wanted neither of those things. All I've ever wanted to do in life is tell stories. I'm enjoying this here right now, sitting talking to you, telling you a story. This is all I've ever wanted to do. But this story about Eileen Angel and her 15 sycophants, if I wanted to make this a worthwhile story, I'd have to spend years with all those people. I hated them all. I hated her especially. There wasn't a day that went past where I didn't want to shake each of them by the shoulders and shout, 'Don't you see what's going on here?' But I didn't. I just left and let them get on with it. I was in such a state by the end of it. I was rather depressed to begin with, truth be told. I didn't want to be a journalist anymore. I hated it. I hated the job. But I had nothing else. I had nowhere else to go. Well, I did have somewhere to go, and I went there. I'll have to skip over that part."
"Does it involve kidnapping, by any chance?" Dennis's smile vanished for a moment, then reappeared again slowly.
"Shh," he whispered.
"I only know this because I went looking for you many years ago. I heard a rumour."
"Let's keep it at that," he said. "A rumour, yes. Let's just say I disappeared for a while."
"How long for?" 12 years, he said. I don't know how best to describe that place. It's similar to going on a retreat. Actually, it's more like a fully funded holiday. I wasn't intending to stay quite so long. 6 months at the most is what most people go for. There's actually a waiting list, would you believe? I was lucky they took a liking to me. I was part of the furniture in the end. I honestly could have lived out my days right there, but it didn't seem right. There was more of the world to see, more people to meet, other things to do, so I left. I moved up here and changed my name to Alex and got a job. I'm happy.
Good for you, I said.
I'm glad to hear it. What job do you do?
I work in a supermarket.
Really? Why is that funny?
It's not funny. I just can't quite imagine it.
You're not looking down on me, I hope. I enjoy my work a lot more than my previous profession.
Honestly, I'm not a snob, Dennis.
Alex.
I'm sorry for laughing, Alex.
Do you think I'm a failure?
Of course I don't.
What do you do, anyway?
I'm a Marty Pello impersonator.
Dennis nearly fell out of his seat. Oh, so my job's a subject for humour, is it? I grinned.
Ha! Of course it is!
Dennis chuckled. You don't look anything like Marty Pello.
That's what I told them when they hired me.
Can you sing? He said.
Enough to get by, I said. If I've learnt anything from this job, it's that most people are unable to distinguish the difference between a professional vocalist and half-decent karaoke.
Oh, so you're a music snob, said Dennis.
You can't impersonate Marty Pello and also be a music snob, I said. It's just an observation anyway, based on my own experience. Everyone likes music on some level. Everyone responds in some way when they hear a good tune. But most people don't actively listen to music. They'll have the radio on in the background while they're working, or stick an album on while they're painting the ceiling. Sometimes they'll hear a song they like and they'll sing along to it. But in doing so, they're not paying attention to the vocalist. They're listening to the sound of their own voice, which is bound to be nowhere near as good. That's how I get away with mimicking a professional singer when I myself am nothing of the kind.
Interesting, he said.
How did we get on to this subject, anyway?
Dennis shrugged.
You mentioned you had a story to tell me, I said. Something about research.
Thanks for reminding me, he said. I've actually brought all the research along.
He pulled a large ring binder from his bag.
Before I open this, he said, you have the option of keeping it closed.
What's in there? I said.
Various bits of information I've gathered about Eileen Angel, he said.
Ha, I said. That's fine, go ahead. I tried researching her myself a few years back.
I know, said Dennis. I met up with Tim Steele. He mentioned having spoken to you.
Ah, Tim, I said brightly. How is he? When did you see him?
A few months back, said Dennis with a curious frown. How is he, you say?
Yes, how is he?
You do know he's in prison, don't you?
What's he in prison for?
What do you think? Presumably it was you that wrote that tip-off to the police about the bodies round the back of Eileen Angel's farmhouse. They found all their equipment. Tim was the first one they caught. He was their nominated parcel boy. Fastest runner amongst them, apparently. He ran down to the gates and signed for their deliveries. Several couriers identified him. In the end, they only caught two of them. Tim plus Leonard Bates, the crooked accountant. The rest of them escaped abroad. Tim and Leonard were happy to name them all. Neither of them mentioned Eileen Angel. Her name didn't come up once in the trial. Equilateral Incorporated did, but no one seems to know who ran the company or even where they were based. We know from our research back in the day that at one time at least she was publicly listed as the owner of the business. Her name was on the deeds to that church and the farm too. But all this secrecy surrounding the sale of the property to some unnamed Russian billionaire muddied the waters somewhat. Apparently the Russians' lawyers put a block on any kind of investigation into the building's ownership, so that was that. I suspect the police still don't have a clue who Eileen Angel is.
What were they charged with? Forgery?
The interesting thing was, the banknotes have entered the general circulation with no proof that they were ever printed on that machine. They must have been damn good forgeries. 10 million quid, floating in and out of our pockets, and no one can tell the difference. So even with their unexplained wealth, there wasn't enough evidence to prosecute. They only got conspiracy to commit fraud, plus a couple of other charges relating to the bodies in the ground. Failure to report them dead, unlawful burial. They were lucky not to get stung for a double murder. The prosecution tried to spin it that way. As it stands, they'll both be out in a couple of years.
Right, I said thoughtfully.
I'm surprised you didn't see it on the news. Quite a big splash in the tabloids.
I don't read the papers, I said.
Very sensible of you. I wish I could say the same myself, but I found the story and it sparked my interest. For the first time in years, I felt the need to investigate something. Maybe it was just that element of unfinished business that got me chasing this up.
I didn't actually mean for any of this to happen, I said. Tim getting put away and all that.
Why do you care?
Turns out he's an old school friend.
Well, to paraphrase a well-worn cliché, Frank, if you don't want to be locked up for conspiracy to commit fraud, failure to report a death and unlawful burial, don't conspire to commit fraud, fail to report a death and unlawfully bury someone. That's what I always say.
I see your point.
Anyway, said Dennis, you've told me you're happy for me to open this file. I'm only warning you again because the contents might surprise you. That's all I'm saying.
Go for it, I said. I thought I'd solved the whole thing myself, to be honest. I tracked him down. He told me everything that went on.
There's more, said Dennis. Much more. Tim doesn't have a clue about any of this stuff.
I even met Eileen herself, I said. Ran into her in a bar one time. 2006, I think it was. She was on her way to Canada.
Funny you should say that, he said.
He opened the folder and presented it to me. Section 1 was marked on a green sheet of card, Canada. I turned the page. There was a newspaper clipping from the Calgary Herald, dated 2001. The story concerned the discovery of a printing press, which had been smashed to pieces and buried in a field beside an industrial unit based in a remote location several miles outside of Calgary. Police are seeking information as to the whereabouts of the business owner, Leanne Skye. Leanne Skye, I said out loud.
You remember the name, right?
I nodded.
Keep reading, he said.
The next section was Bergen in Norway. A news story dated 2003. Another abandoned printing press in a derelict building. Norwegian police had local business owner Ellen Moon as a person of interest. Finally, the Republic of Ireland, 2005. Broken printing press, abandoned farmhouse. The police had named a specific sum of money this time. The forgers are believed to have produced up to 100 million euros. The name connected to the site was Aisling Kraft.
This is incredible, I said. I agree, he said. I know I said I hated her earlier, and trust me I do, but I have to say, this is very, very, very impressive.
I'm just trying to piece all these dates together, I said, and the thousands of air miles.
We know there were gaps in her CV, said Dennis. In the 80s and 90s, before these schemes all reached their logical conclusions, she was only based in the UK part of the time. We can assume she was also recruiting in at least three other countries.
Surely there can't be a fourth, I said. How would she have the time?
Lynn Heaven, said Dennis. That name doesn't come up anywhere. That's how I gathered all these stories together, by the way. It might look like I put a lot of effort into all this, but it was easy as crossing the street. All I needed to do was run a search through all the press archives with Eileen Angel's aliases. This is what came up. And you know what? You've probably guessed this already, but the cases were never solved. A few arrests were made in Ireland and Norway, but like our friends Tim and Leonard, none of them were willing to name their beloved mistress.
Christ, I said. I know I shouldn't say this, but I'd love to meet her again. Just for an afternoon, just to hear her side of the story.
Do you think she'd tell you?
Maybe, I said. She'd had a few drinks when I saw her last. She was remarkably honest. She claimed to be enjoying her retirement.
I doubt it, Dennis muttered.
Why?
People like her don't just retire. Eileen Angel isn't a wanted woman yet. Plus, she has a whole unused persona. Lynn Heaven. Plus, whatever her real name is. Presumably, she has a ridiculous amount of money and 24 hours a day's worth of time on her hands. God knows what she's capable of.
He paused, looking me in the eye.
Of course, he said. You could blow her whole world apart with all this. He tapped the file. The pattern of identical crimes, her aliases, all the things we've seen and heard between us. Leave me out of it. I realised a long time ago that telling these kind of stories just isn't for me. Researching them is fun. Old habits die hard and all that. Consider this a gift to you, Frank. You were always a talented writer. I love your work. I read your collection, by the way, A History of Sarcasm. What a book! I knew you could do it. Thanks, I said. I really appreciate that. Why not make Eileen Angel your next book? It'll be a hell of a departure, but this thing's got bestseller written all over it. I don't know about that, I said. I mean, I'm sure it'll sell a few copies, but it turns out I'm very much like you, Dennis. I have no desire to be famous. All I have is the desire to write. I'll tell you what I like to do, he said. It relates back to that rumour, you know, the one about me being in captivity for 12 years. Well, it turns out 12 years is a long time to be sitting around doing nothing. So I wrote a book. Then I wrote another one. A couple of years later, there was time for a third. All of them jotted down by hand in a series of notebooks. When it came time for me to leave, my captors made a thorough inspection of my personal possessions and confiscated the notebooks. I asked why I couldn't take them with me. They said, "Do these memoirs of yours mention this place?" I said, "Yes, kind of." They said, "In that case, we'll have to destroy them." I said, "Hang on. Would it be okay if I destroy them myself? You guys can watch. It'll feel like more of a ceremony then." They agreed. Let me build a bonfire with the notebooks in the middle. I stood back and watched all those words disappear into smoke. It was strangely liberating. Anyway, that's what I do now. I write everything down, all my thoughts, insecurities, whatever's been bothering me that day. It all goes down on paper, and then I set the paper on fire, and the words are gone. It feels like I've been cleansed somehow. Cool, I said. I'm glad that works for you. We bought another drink. I tried to kick off a chat where we reminisced about old times, but Dennis was much more interested in telling me about finding a bag of lemons on top of a postbox last week, and he wondered what the lemons were doing there. It seemed like he was much happier talking about the present, so I let him get on with that. He mentioned that he's reconnected with his kids. They were both in their early 30s now. They came to see him sometimes. He'd apologised for being a useless father, which apparently they'd accepted. "I even have a grandchild on the way," he said, blinking back a tear at the thought. "That's what they call me, you know, Miss Angel's lot, down in Devon. That was my nickname, Grandad. Never thought I'd get to be one for real." I'd brought along a gift for him, too. His old trench coat had been sitting in my wardrobe for years, and I thought he might be pleased to see it again. Seeing how happy he was with his new life and how disinterested he was in his old one, it didn't seem appropriate, so I kept it in my bag. When I got home that evening, I threw the coat in the bin. Not out of anger or anything, I just didn't have a need for it. After a couple of minutes' careful consideration, I threw away Dennis's ring binder, too. He wasn't the only one who wanted to leave the past where it was. As nice as it had been to see Dennis again, we never got around to another meeting. Now and again we'd exchange jokes or messages, but that dried up too after a couple of years, which is fine. We're both very different people now. I'd spent a long time coming to terms with the fact that people disappear or move on with their lives. Just so you know, I'm okay with it now. It's not a tragedy. It's necessary. The freedom to waltz off into the sunset is what prevents us all from killing each other. I considered calling this book "Here's a Long List of People I'm Never Going to See Again," which would have summed it all up nicely, as downbeat as that sounded. Instead, I called it "Endless Impossible," which doesn't really mean anything, but sounds good, and maybe that's all that matters.
Thank you for listening. If you're interested, there's the footnotes section coming up after the theme song. I can't tell you anything about it. It's only for the hardcore members of the Ragbag Alliance. Please take a look at my website, frankburton.co.uk, where you'll find The Green Room, a webcomic about celebrities in the afterlife. There's also the Ragbag Rambler video series, and much, much more besides. My other podcast is called I Like the Sound, and we've got some great stuff coming up on that very soon indeed. I will see you soon.
We're all alone, no chaperone can get our number. The world's in slumber, let's misbehave.
something wild about you, child, that's so contagious. Let's be outrageous, let's misbehave. When Adam won Eve's hand, he wouldn't stand for teasing. He didn't care about those apples out of season. They say the spring means just one thing to little lovebirds. We're not above birds, let's misbehave. Let's misbehave. Let's misbehave.
If you'd be just so sweet and only meet your fate, dear, 'twould be the great event of 1928, dear.
Let's misbehave. Let's misbehave.
Well, it's all over. It's all finished. My God. Welcome to the footnotes for the final time. Welcome to the final footnotes. The next episode is going to be Ragbag's fourth wall. Now, there's no footnote section for that because the whole thing is one big long ramble from me talking about how the story was written, how it was put together, what the influences on it are, and all that sort of thing, taking a big deep dive into the construction of this long form narrative, which is going to be published as a novel, of course, as well. The fourth Ragbag novel, Endless Impossible. Watch out for that. Watch out for that. You just listen to the whole thing. Still, I'm promoting the thing that you have literally spent hours listening to. I presume that you have. If you're listening to this now, you'll have heard all eight episodes of the story. Unless you're, for some reason, listening to them in the wrong order for a laugh. Don't do that. The spoilers in this one, obviously, this is a big reveal in this episode, which you're not supposed to know about until you get to this one. Anyway, I'm not telling you how to live your life. But yes, this is the final footnote. So yeah, here we are. And we've got quite a few footnotes to get through, actually. One thing that I found out the other day, which I didn't know about, was this song that I've been using as the theme song, Let's Misbehave, was actually used in a Woody Allen film. It was in the title sequence of the Woody Allen movie, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Too Afraid to Ask. Is that what it's called? Something along those lines, isn't it? It's a bit of a mouthful, that one. And as soon as I found that out, you know, you know how people feel about Woody Allen, don't you? I'm sure there's a lot of reasons to dislike Woody Allen. Just finding out that the song that I'd chosen as the theme song to play in every single episode in its entirety on Endless Impossible was also the theme song for a Woody Allen film. Oh, God. But, you know, the song's got nothing to do with Woody Allen. It's a Cole Porter song, and everyone loves Cole Porter, don't they? Surely they do. Let's not have that association. Let's not talk about Woody Allen anymore. That film, I remember watching that film. I haven't seen it for like 25 years or something. I remember finding it very funny indeed. I don't know whether it's still funny, whether those jokes in the 21st century would really land in the same way. I don't know, and I don't particularly want to watch it again to find out. First of all, big shout out to Katie Hearn Church from the Queen's podcast. So that big long quote, which references lots of different historical figures. I won't name all the historical figures again because we'll be here all day. But obviously Katie Hearn Church knows what she is talking about. I highly recommend listening to the Queen's podcast. As the title would suggest, it's a history show which every week they take a kind of deep dive into the life of a female historical figure, usually a queen, not necessarily a queen every time. But that is the point of that show, and it's a great podcast. And I came across this quotation. I've used it as a quotation. It actually originated as a Twitter thread, would you believe? And I was trying to articulate this bit of learning at the end where I say, like, you know, for what it's worth, this is what I've learnt from these experiences, which is not something that I would usually do in the Ragbag Stories, but I felt the need to do it this time. And I couldn't really put it into words, and somehow stumbled across this Twitter thread that Katie had written on the Queen's Podcast Twitter. And it was fantastic. It just articulated absolutely everything that I was trying to say. So follow them on Twitter. I'm not calling it X, but because there's some good stuff on there. And obviously listen to the podcast as well. It's a great, great thing. So big, big thank you to Katie for getting back to me when I got in touch and said I want to use this quotation in this book that I've written. And, you know, she obviously said go ahead, and that's cool. So that's great. Let's see what else there is. Now, at one point, Frank uses the expression, "I admire your chutzpah," which long-term listeners will recognise as one of the original catchphrases from the kind of early episodes of the Ragbag podcast. So I've thrown that in there. I think it's the first time the words "I admire your chutzpah" has made it in to a Ragbag book. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I might have got it in before, but I don't recall having used that in one of the books before. So there you go. "I admire your chutzpah." References to all of the things that Tim missed out on while he was part of Miss Angel's community. So Tony Blair, who has made a personal appearance, we can even call him friend of the show. Friend of the show, Tony Blair, was very much in the novel Getting Away With It. So he had a speaking role in that. I had fun doing the voice for the audio version. I don't know how well I did as Tony Blair. Yeah. It's all about the pauses with Blair, I think. He just several pauses per sentence. "It was the best of times. It was the worst of times." Any sentence, just put several pauses in the middle of a sentence. No apparent reason. Don't know why he does all them pauses when he's talking. Because he doesn't put a great deal of thought into what he says. Anyway, let's not get sidetracked by Mr. Tony Blair. I think we've had enough of that one. Reference to the Matrix trilogy and the Star Wars prequels. There you go. Telstar, obviously that was one of the nicknames of the cult members. And Telstar, I believe, is this satellite communication system. I don't know very much about it, but that is the name of this. So they nicknamed him after a satellite. They are the Nerd Army, aren't they? So it's a very nerdy joke, that one. We have pointed out this episode sees the first two deaths in the Ragbag series. There have not been any deaths. Up until this point, we got through three whole books with no deaths. We do reference the fake death that takes place in Brolywood. And I won't go into it. It's a bit of a spoiler if I go into that. So I won't go into that if you haven't read or listened to Brolywood. Just so you know, there's a fake death in there. Okay, I've given it away, but there you have it. There's a reference to a book called A History of Sarcasm by Frank Burton. That sounds good. And a much welcome reference, I would say, to Marty Pello of the band Wet Wet Wet, who... So this is, if you're familiar with Brolywood, the story, either the audio or the book, it doesn't matter, they're both the same. Frank spends quite an extended period of that book impersonating Marty Pello, which used to be his job. He said, "It used to be my job. I used to be a Marty Pello impersonator." But we didn't get to see that period in his life firsthand until now. So at this time when he's meeting Dennis at the end of this story, this is the period in his life in which he's working as a Marty Pello impersonator. So there you have it. It all ties in together, doesn't it? It all ties up nicely, that, yeah. Yeah, that are all the references that I wrote down, unless I missed them out. Well, it's Humpty Dumpty again. Humpty Dumpty comes up again. Oh, the great Humpty Dumpty, yeah. What's your favourite Humpty Dumpty album? My favourite Humpty Dumpty album is The Wall. He was in Pink Floyd, wasn't he, Humpty Dumpty? Wasn't he? No. Oh, I'm losing the plot. It's It's a real end-of-term feeling around here, I can tell you that. We've put a lot of work into this whole thing, and now it's the end. It's quite an emotional thing, really. But we're not done yet, obviously. I'm yet to record the Ragbags Fourth Wall, where we go into... Hopefully we'll get right under the skin of this story and right under the skin of these characters and right under the skin of Frank Burton himself. I'm talking about myself in the third person again, and it's fun to do that. Once I've done that, this whole project will be done and I can just release it all into the world and see what you think. Yeah. And I'm going to have a bit of a break before I do the fifth and final Ragbag novel, which hasn't got a title yet. But I've got the whole thing kind of sketched out in my head. It's going to be, as I've alluded to in this passage where I talk about it, it is going to be quite a bit darker and there is going to be a lot more death in the final one. Because unless I have a complete change of heart, but at the moment it's very much a story about a serial killer. We've done various different crime stories, haven't we? We've done the missing person story, we've done bank heist, we've done whatever Getting Away With It was about. It's difficult to describe what that was about, but that was a big crime story, wasn't it? Endless Impossible is a crime story, of course, as well. So fifth one's going to be a serial killer one, and then, oh, there you go. That's your lot, man. That's your lot. So, yeah, let's summarise, shall we? Because I feel like I should summarise. I've talked about lots of different things over the course of the last few footnotes episodes. And I've been going off on one quite a lot. I've been very critical of other writers and stuff like that. And I don't want to give you the impression that I'm just like a bitter old man. Because I'm not. And the reason why I'm not is that, first of all, I'm just kind of expressing my opinion. And I know that a lot of you will disagree with certain things that I've said in these footnote sections, like Jonathan Franzen, for example. A lot of you are probably big fans of Jonathan Franzen, and you've read The Corrections and you thought The Corrections were a great novel. And of course, you are entitled to that opinion. I'm entitled to mine as well. But if you think The Corrections was a great novel, then that's great. I'm glad that you enjoyed it. And I don't want that to come across as me being bitter, because obviously, Jonathan Franzen is much, much more commercially successful than I am. And that's fine. Good for him. I recently came to the realization that I don't want that for myself. I don't want to have that level of commercial success. Definitely don't want to be famous and really not interested in being rich either. I mean, as long as I've got a roof over my head and I can pay the bills and I've got a bit of money left over at the end of the month to spend on cool stuff, I don't need £1 million in the bank. It would probably go to my head, and I probably wouldn't handle it very well if I was rich. I certainly wouldn't handle fame very well, I don't think. I think it would be pretty bad for my mental health, and I might even just completely go off the rails if suddenly overnight millions of people know who I am. I'd be very uncomfortable with that. So when I say these really critical things about other writers, I'm saying it because that's my opinion. I'm not saying because I'm in any way jealous of their success, because I genuinely don't want their success. I think it's good for them. I don't think it would be good for me. And I'm very happy being an anonymous figure. And as I say, I'm on the verge of becoming an anonymous writer. I'm going to start writing books anonymously and no one is going to know that it was me that wrote them. I'm really excited about this idea. I really am. I think it's the way forward for me. I don't think it's the way forward for... I'm not suggesting for one moment that everybody should be doing this, but it's the way forward for me. I think I'm going to produce some good work this way because I'm not going to be concerned about what people think of me or what my public image is going to be as a result of this thing. It's just not going to matter. And that sounds like, oh, I'm gonna suddenly start doing like really controversial things. I'm not going to be doing controversial things. I'm just going to be creating some great works of art, hopefully. I can't really say any more about that because I'm not going to be promoting the works of this anonymous guy on here. I also had a few things to say in these footnote sections about people who kind of rail against political correctness and rail against what they call cancel culture. And it's not something that I'm going to be talking about in any other form. I'm not going to be writing books about this subject. I'm not going to be talking about it in the main section of any of the podcasts. I'm only talking about it in this kind of extra bonus content section. which is for you and me, the hardcore enthusiasts. First of all, because lots and lots and lots of people are talking about these things, and it gets pretty boring after a while, doesn't it? I don't want to be known as the guy who talks about political correctness or cancel culture or whatever it is you want to call it, because everyone is talking about this stuff. Also, there isn't really any point in talking about it because you're not going to change anyone's opinions. No one is going to listen to me rambling on about cancel culture and think, oh yeah, this guy's got a point. Either you agree with me already or you don't. And presumably, if that's the case, you've already made your mind up on the subject. So what is the point in talking about it at all, really, I suppose? I think what is useful is to just really like highlight how wrong this whole thing is. Like, most of the claims that these kind of free speech warriors are making are completely false. And the opposite is true in a lot of the cases. If you take Pride Month as an example of this, and you get a lot of companies, corporations putting the Pride flag on top of their logos for the month. And then, of course, you get all of these free speech warriors hilariously boycotting these companies because apparently they've become infected by the woke agenda. And of course, the opposite is true. The opposite is true. They're just trying to make money. That is all they're trying to do. Any company that puts a pride flag over top of their logo for a month isn't doing it because they support the LGBT community. Absolutely not. They're not doing it for that. They're doing it because it'll make them more money. They've done their market research. They've figured out, if I put a pride flag on the logo for a month, that will increase our revenue. You know, these companies don't care about gay people or trans people one way or the other. Because companies don't have feelings. Companies don't have beliefs or ethics. Companies exist in order to make money. And I guarantee you, if they did their market research and found out that putting a swastika on their logo would make them more money, they would do it. They absolutely would. They absolutely would. And it's not because they're Nazis. They don't have any political views. They are not human beings. They are companies who exist in order to make money. You can say that they're infected by the woke agenda if you like, but it's more the case that society is, you know, because they're a reflection of society. And if society is telling you that they support pride, then these companies want to get on the back of it. If society in general is against Pride Month, then the companies aren't going to want to have anything to do with it. So it is a reflection of society as a whole. You can see where these things are coming from. And clearly, what we're seeing from this is that if you're not the sort of person who supports Pride Month, for whatever reason that might be, then you're in a minority. And frankly, that is wonderful. If you're as old as I am, and you lived in the United Kingdom for as long as I have, you will remember a time when the opposite was true of that. The majority of people were against that sort of thing. It's right there in living memory. Our culture at the end of the 20th century was what we recognise today as being just extremely homophobic, to the extent that the high school that I went to in the 1990s literally had no openly gay students. And the very idea of there being a single openly gay student in that school, that would have been unthinkable at the time, just because of the way that culture was. You say this to teenagers now, that there were no openly gay people at my school. It's absolutely unbelievable to them. So somebody who, like me, who grew up around that kind of culture, to witness what's happening now and seeing that people who are against the idea of Pride Month being in a very clear minority, it's revolutionary. It really is. It's the whole thing has been turned on its head in what seems like a very short space of time, really. I know that there is still progress to be made and homophobia is still a thing, but it's no longer the mainstream view that it once was. So that's a nice little note to end on, isn't it? A note of positivity there, really. And I have been obviously writing very much about the 20th century. Most of it is set in the 1990s, and none of this stuff about sexuality comes up during the story, but it is worth noting at this point that that is very much what the society was like at that time. And I guess this story isn't supposed to be a reflection of the culture of the 1990s. As a matter of fact, I think you can listen to it or read it, and you could probably forget for most of it the time period in which it was set. Because in a way, the time period isn't that important. It just happens to be at that time because the character is 9 years old when the story starts. Obviously, it spans about 3 decades, and we end up kind of in the present day. The story doesn't have much to say about the present day either. The story is kind of this fairly self-contained thing that doesn't really have much to do with the wider culture of the time in which it's set. Sometimes we do that in the Ragbag universe. I mean, Brollywood was set during the pandemic, and it was inevitable that we had to address things that were going on in society, in wider society at that time. But generally, I don't feel the need to comment too much on what's going on at the time. There's a reference to 9/11, actually, which I missed out from the footnotes. I just saw that on the notes. So, yeah, 9/11 was referenced in this bit. It was also, there's a chapter in Getting Away With It that is set on September 11, 2001. And you see the character's reaction to watching these events unfold on the TV. And again, it's one of those things, it's difficult to write a story that's set in the year 2001 without at some point mentioning that 9/11 happened. Because it's one of those things that everyone was talking about for a long time, and it kind of changed the way people saw the world in a way. In a similar way, I guess, to the way that the pandemic did. But anyway, I was trying to end on a positive note, and now I ended up talking about 9/11 and the pandemic. Earlier on, I was saying that's a good note to end on, nice positive note. And then, you know, a couple of minutes later, oh yeah, forgot about 9/11, didn't I? Anyway, it's been very nice talking to you for the last few hours of my life, or whatever, however long I've invested into making these footnotes things. I feel like I've been doing it for years on end. I'll be back with the next series of Ragbag, whatever that's going to be called, and we will do the footnotes again, because I do find it personally useful to investigate all these kind of cultural references that come out in the stories, and it just gives me a, let's face it, it gives me the opportunity just to gob off, as we say in the podcasting world. Check out Ragbag's Fourth Wall also, because that's going to be fun, and yeah, I will see you soon.